listeners to connect the dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of food, health, and the environment. We talk a great deal on this program about policy, advocacy, science, and all of the things that connect our personal health and well-being and the health of our planet and society, to ourselves and our families and communities. And that's what we've been talking about each week on Connect the Dots for the last 6 years, actually. And we're coming up on our anniversary soon. So each week we talk to different authors, advocates, filmmakers, scientists, experts, and all different people who address different facets of our interconnected world. On today's show, we're going to be doing a show that focuses both on science and policy in a key area that affects us, our health, and our food supply extremely directly for reasons we'll find out. My guest today is biologist Sainath Suryanarayanan. He, along with his co-author, sociologist Daniel Lee Kleinman, is the author of a new book called Vanishing Bees, Science, Politics, and Honeybee Health. And this is kind of doing a deeper dive into a specific area of science, than we often will do on the program, and it's for very important reasons that you'll find out. Professor Suryanarayanan is an assistant scientist for the study of transdisciplinary biomedical research in the Department of Population Health Sciences, and he's also an associate lecturer at the Host Center for Science and Technology Studies at the University of Wisconsin, Madison. His new book, Vanishing Bees, Science, Politics, and Honeybee Health, is almost a kind of whodunit about, what is going on with our honeybees, which, are really core to our having a healthy food supply. And we'll learn a lot more about that on today's program. And I know that all the foodies and food activists who listen to this show regularly will be very interested in hearing, how one single species is so connected to what we need to have a healthy ecology and food supply and planet Earth, as well as what our species needs for life. So welcome to Connect the Dots, Professor Suryanarayanan. So happy to have you here today with us.
Thank you, Allison. Thank you for having me, and you can call me Sai.
Okay, Sai. Very good. So first off, your book talks about what we have been witnessing for a number of years, which is massive die-offs of bees and hives, which is known by the name of colony collapse disorder. This is something, or we can talk about it, under the abbreviation CCD. Is this something that appeared suddenly, and when did it start, and what does it actually mean? Like, what are beekeepers and other biologists like yourself seeing in this regard?
So CCD is part of a broader set of increases in the levels of honeybee deaths that have been seen over the past decade or so. CCD was first recognized by some commercial large-scale beekeepers around 2005-06 in their beekeeping operations. And it was a set of symptoms that they had never seen before. We are talking veteran beekeepers who have been keeping bees for over three decades. And so let me say a little bit about CCD.
Please.
So these were seemingly healthy beehives. When beekeepers opened them, they found literally ghost towns, no adult bees, usually in a healthy honeybee hive. It would be teeming with adult bees buzzing around doing various activities. But these were just silent, eerie places, no adult bees, just gone, leaving behind rich stores of nectar and pollen. So these beehives were not starving. There were also large stores of young offspring, brood, and a queen. So seemingly everything was normal, except the bees were gone, and there were no piles of dead bee bodies in front of these beehives, which would usually have been the case with, say, a traditional acute pesticide kill, or a kill due to a particular parasite called varroa mites, which continue to be a scourge for beekeepers. But the telltale symptoms of either varroa or pesticide kill, acute kill, were not there, and the bee bodies were missing. Additionally, another curious thing was that the left behind nectar, which would usually be robbed by neighboring bees, a beehive that's not well guarded would soon have parties gatecrashing it to try and get hold of the nectar and pollen. But in the collapsing beehives, the stored nectar was left untouched. We don't know why, but that that left, what something was smelling not right. Something didn't seem right for robbing bees, and they didn't rob this stuff. Anyway, this set of symptoms came to be called colony collapse disorder by honeybee scientists working with the U.S. Department of Agriculture and various land-grant universities.
Let me just ask a question. Let me ask a question, Dr. Tsai. What, you know, for people who, you know, members of the general public and the listeners to my show, you know, we know that bees are pollinators. You know, how... but, you know, a lot of people may not be as thoroughly familiar as you are with how essential they are to both other species, like in terms of what pollinating bees do, as well as to our own food supply. You know, what role do bees play and how essential are they to the food supply? And, you know, is what we're seeing constituting some kind of threat, either near or far range, to the human food supply?
Yeah, crucial question. And honeybees are absolutely crucial to our current system of agriculture, and you know, they are responsible, many folks say, for over a third of what we eat. So a lot of the fruits, vegetables, nuts, and even fibers that we consume or use are shaped and affected by honeybees, either in terms of the quantity of those crops and or the quality of those crops. So the quantity and quality can be affected by pollination, by insect pollination. And honeybees have come to be very crucial for farmers who are depending on these bees for pollinating their crops. So every year, over 2 million beehives are rented out from beekeepers, and farmers pay often a handsome price for renting out beehives for pollinating various crops. And so we have greater than $17 billion annually that can be attributed to honeybee and pollination services for the agricultural ecosystem that we depend on.
So here we are, and, you know, you know, human beings, you know, we think we're so great and we did it all. And what you were, you know, we do it all, and it's all attributed to us and our work and what we do. But, you know, here you're showing one of the greatest possible kinds of interdependence that we have with another species, not, you know, just, for example, our pets whom we like, or, you know, other forms of animals that we may, you know, some people may consume, but even the very, you know, the very grains and crops that those animals consume, or the fruits and grains and crops that we consume in conjunction, or would have as the first option to consume if there were no other livestock animals who were, you know, who we were consuming, all of that, you know, I mean,
right.
We'd be living on water or something if, you know,
and grains.
I mean, which is, you know, I mean, these are all the basic subsistence foods, both for ourselves and for other mammals. This is a profound interdependence, and, you know, we're big and we have our own kind of intelligence and organization, but, you know, here is another species that is organized and playing a crucial role. Have we, due to CCD and these massive die-offs, are we experiencing a reduction in our food crops, or could one be in the offing, you know, in the near or long term as a result of this puzzling die-off?
In the immediate term, no. In the immediate term, what we are facing are prospects of increasing prices of foods. And these are, while I don't have direct evidence to say that food price increases are caused due to the honeybee collapses, what we do have is some circumstantial evidence. For example, where around 2005-06, when the bee die-offs started, the new bee die-offs, almond growers, for example, who depend on honeybees for making almonds, became desperate to find bees, and they really upped their rental bee prices, what they were willing to pay beekeepers to bring their beehives over to pollinate. And so what has happened in the bee industry is certainly that the amount of revenues generated through pollination and the amount of money that farmers are willing to shell out to pollinate their crops has increased substantially. And that increase that farmers are shelling out can have a trickle-down effect down to consumers who are buying those crops, or the crop commodities. And we can see a downstream effect on the increases in our food prices. Now, that would immediately mean that certain foods, you know, fresh market fruits, vegetables that are already hard for certain strata of people to access, will become harder to access.
That's very troubling.
Immediate.
So what you're saying is that poor people, people with lower income, lower economic status, will see basic foods becoming more expensive and harder to access, and that's beginning to happen already. So,
yeah.
You know, this situation actually, and once again, we're seeing where, you know, divides exist between those of, you know, greater or lesser privilege in our society and in our world. And, you know, the challenge is in all areas, it seems, because I cover many polluting industries, you know, such as fracking, for example, or climate change. You know, I cover chemical toxicity. I cover many different industrial activities across the board that can lead to a polluting or undermining effect on healthy human and ecological processes. That's kind of part of the range of what I cover. But we're seeing across the board, one of the problems that we've had in coping with any of this is a kind of failure of information, and also, or you know, a kind of inadequate information, inadequate research, or inadequate knowledge about the information, as well as a loss of, you know, a kind of a weaker will in addressing these things, and precisely because they affect people of less means first, and those who, you know, are maybe closer to centers of power later. So these problems tend to be dismissed and then go on and on and on until they become nearly impossible to address. I mean, we see that with climate. We see that on multiple fronts. We see it on practically every front that I've been covering over the last decade and more. Can you... You know, so that is, you know, here again we're seeing that same pattern. So what is the current status, Dr. Tsai, of scientific knowledge about what's going on? And, you know, what is is it clearly known what is causing this? What do we know? What don't we know? Can you familiarize our listeners, you know, with that, please?
Yeah, that's a good question. We know a lot since these die-offs started due to the amazing and brilliant work of various honeybee scientists and also beekeepers. What we know is that colony collapse disorder as such is a complex phenomenon. And by complex, we're talking about multiple factors, not just one single factor causing it, but multiple factors that are interacting and synergizing possibly over time in complicated ways. And so that's the consensus right now. And in terms of what factors these could be, there have been there has been a certain narrowing down of the list of possible culprits. So these include certain pesticides, such as some newer classes of insecticides. We have the varroa mite parasite. We also have various microbial pathogens, viruses, and fungi, as well as nutrition issues in monocultural settings where bees can access only not diverse kinds of pollen and nectar. So what we're seeing is none of these factors by themselves, right? The consensus is that these factors together are somehow leading to the broader die-offs. How these factors are interacting, which of these factors are more prominent, etc., these are unresolved issues.
This is very interesting because, I mean, this is fascinating to me because you basically, in what you just said, you touched on two things that I think that, I mean, as someone who has covered science for many years that I'm acquainted with, but which is, I think many people are unacquainted with, don't think about, even though perhaps it's intuitively obvious that many different factors would act together to produce a greater effect than what a single line of causation would produce, even though we see that intuitively going on in our world all the time. You know, we have been almost entrained, I feel, in a scientific understanding that tells us, you know, one cause, one factor, one mechanism, one, you know, it's this. And so we're always, it's almost like we've become, developed an understanding based on TV detective shows, you know, where there's one bad guy, there's one perpetrator or, you know, killer or whatever, or, you know, on science, there's one mechanism in the body that one pharmaceutical drug targets. And, you know, whereas the body is living and interactive, which of course, you know, you're a biologist, you know it better than I do. But we, you know, in general, I think the public has been taught maybe by all of the pharmaceutical advertising or just in general through simplification in the media, which is, you know, my vocational field. You know, we've just been taught to target one thing and then just get all worked up and say it's all about that, when in fact we live in an interactive complex.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Really hard to understand. Now, I think biologists, like yourself, both have to focus on, you know, individual things, but also in my experience, I mean, my favorite conversations are sometimes with biologists because you learn to look interactively. You learn to see things as interconnected and multifactorial, and it's not just one cause, one soundbite. I mean, I think here we're talking about, bees in this specific complex, but I also think that biologists above all would be the ones who really understand what we've just been discussing. So I just want to step back a little bit from our topic for a minute and just ask you, as a biologist, how you see all of these factors in interaction and why it's hard for both the general public, our government, industry, to understand the interactive complex of living biology and nature. I'd love to hear your view of that. I'm kind of putting words in your mouth. Maybe you don't see it that way. Please correct me if I'm wrong. But if you have any insights into that or experiences of it, I would love to hear them.
Yeah, that's a great question, and I want to step back a little bit even further from where you started and just preface my comments by saying that I consider myself not only just a biologist, but also very deeply a sociologist of science and a social scientist of biology. I see myself as sort of bridging those two, and so that's a prefatory comment to what I'm going to say, which is that from the honeybee case, and we show this in the book, interestingly, it's also the entomologists who are involved, who, even though their talk is of multifactorial complexity, the actual walk, the actual experiments are geared toward looking at individual factors and their isolated effects. And this, in a way, sets it up for the general public and industry, as well as governmental representatives, to see these issues, these very complex issues, from simplified, simplistic perspectives. Okay? And mm-hmm. so it's not only the general public and industry and governmental representatives, but academia and also the way academic career structures for scientists are set up that shape how scientists actually do their experiments. In this case, we're talking entomologists. And so having been in entomology, having worked in entomology, and now kind of bridging entomology from a social scientific perspective, this is one observation I want to make in response to your question. The second is that, again, from a honeybee standpoint, scientists, there are amazing entomologists who are working on this issue, and many of them, if not all of them, will recognize the complex nature of a beehive. It's a superorganism in a sense. There's tens of thousands of honeybees interacting with each other. That's just in a one beehive, right? And these beehives are situated in landscapes with which the beehives are interacting. So we're talking foraging and on pollen, nectar of various plants, and these plants are there in many ways due to how various human land managers may be treating them, right? Either through development or cropping. And so there's, a very complex set of issues when you're looking at honeybee health. But the way entomology developed in the 20th century, and we show this in the book, if you look historically, entomology developed as a science of developing insecticides to kill insects. That's mm-hmm. the historical context It's a context of agriculture and intensive chemical agriculture that we're talking, in which entomology as a profession developed. Land-grant universities and agricultural scientists had the direct mandate to help farmers come up with practical solutions to deal with insect pests. And the way agricultural scientists did it is by developing chemicals to target insects. So the initial experimental approaches and tools and methodologies that came up in entomology were geared toward looking at the direct effects of chemicals, direct killing effects, lethal effects, and how fast they can kill the insects. And insects and their life cycles were studied from these perspectives. Now,
I just want to interject there for a minute that, here it's interesting because, I just want to note the shift that happened in entomology, and just and I think to many listeners this may sound like, oh well, of course, but here we have a group of scientists who are studying insects, and that is their work and their specialty, and they are, for reasons of industry and industrial agriculture, they are studying them to figure out how to kill them for a human purpose. Now, we just take for granted we wouldn't have food somehow, and that's an assumption. May not be true. People have had food for millennia, without this kind of chemical industrial interference in the natural order. And so I'm not saying today that I know how this could be done on the mass scale that would be needed for our time, although it is something that organic and other forms of agriculture, traditional agriculture, have sought to do. But here in our time, we have recruited those who study the insects to the industrial purpose of figuring out how to kill them, using these novel chemicals and poisons, and then we take for granted that's a necessity, and then we kind of tune out that it's happening, and then it's a possibility because these kinds of things are not looked at for long-range systemic effects of any type, so that we do in effect a mass experiment, and then at the end of the day something happens that is undesirable, and we kind of we've already let the cat out of the bag, so to speak, and so, you can't then so easily take it back or know precisely what it was that caused a later problem. And then instead of doing that, figuring out these multiple causes, then you have the same, people trying to figure out whether it was one thing or another thing. And then again, my question to you as a sociologist of science is, who is paying for this kind of research? Are the scientists who are doing this research doing it funded by or at the behest of industry that is supporting their academic departments? How is it that are they free to find any cause whatsoever, even if it meant saying to a particular industry, your product is contributing to this? Or, how is that situated? In other words, is the research truly independent, open-ended, and honest in being able to discover the root of the problem or the multiple causes of the problem?
So, that's a complex question, and it has many different places there that nodes that we can open up. Let me open up one of those nodes, which is, as I was talking about the history of entomology developing in an agro-industrial context, I want to stress here that industry really did not come into play in terms of capturing scientists until later on in the 20th century. A lot of this initial research into chemicals and chemical ways of targeting insects was actually driven by the United States Department of Agriculture. And that was kind of the view taken to helping growers with their pest management solutions. It was something that worked when they tried. And when it worked, they figured out, okay, we can do this and develop other ways to, in the short term, kill insects and provide solutions. And as you noted, that there were long-range systemic effects that and sublethal effects, meaning effects that did not directly outright kill insects, beneficial insects, but had pernicious, chronic, and sublethal effects that weakened them in many ways, and which is what we're seeing with honeybees. Those issues did not get systematically investigated, partly also because of the training that entomologists got. They were trained to be like the hard science folks, like chemistry. They were trained to be having a hard science, quote-unquote, view of the world. And they were not trained in ecology, for example. Okay, so entomologists who had certain kinds of training then came and started, were looking at insects and looking at life structures. And these are the very same people and very same institutions then that also got enrolled into looking at why beneficial insects like honeybees were suffering in this context as beekeepers started coming to them. And unsurprisingly, the very same techniques that got used to kill insects, how to kill insects, then got used to figure out how these chemicals were affecting beneficial insects. So again, what was looked at mainly was rapid, lethal, direct effects of individual chemicals, not synergies, not long-term effects. And this is the story that we have mainly today. And so the approach to complexity taken by entomologists is shaped by this whole history of the discipline and profession. Now, where does industry come in? Now, I would say that in many ways, agrochemical companies, especially starting from the mid-20th century, have shaped and affected how scientists, agricultural scientists, study their objects of interest. But I wouldn't call the scientists captured or determined by industry interests. There are multiple factors shaping science. One of them, yes, is industry. But there's also many other factors. There's the scientists' own career and professional interests, their own investigations and their own curiosities. So when it comes to the independence, are scientists really independent in pursuing whatever they want? That's a double-edged question. It really comes down to what do we mean by independence? And if you're talking about independence from direct industry effect, I would say yes, there are many scientists who are independent from direct industry effects, who are pursuing the issue of honeybee decline through taxpayer dollars and public monies, and that they are relatively free to ask the questions that they're asking. But there are also, of course, industry-sponsored studies, and there are industry-sponsored scientists. Recently, the New York Times had a profile of one such scientist and his dealings with Syngenta in relation to Syngenta's insecticide and the scientist's work on honeybees. And how his work was affected by non-disclosure agreements that he had to sign with industry, which affected what he could publish and possibly how he could publish certain findings that may not sit in line with the industry's interests. So, of course, these issues are there, but the book that Daniel Kleinman and I wrote emphasizes that that these issues may be happening in the margins, but what we are seeing is something more pernicious, more mundane, which is how scientists' ways of approaching complexity, in this case the complexity of honeybee decline, are control-oriented. Their emphasis on precision and control of their experiments then leads to us overlooking the complexity and interactive reality in which bees are dying.
So in other words, scientists, you know, in part because of industry control and in part because of a kind of lack of independence and freedom, or for other reasons, are kind of always looking for this, you know, or many of them get stuck in only looking for this single cause thing. And you know, one of the things that happens is if you're, you know, if you do that early in your career and you continue doing it, anything that you keep doing or anything you keep reading or thinking, actually, influences your ability to perceive the next thing and the next and the next and the next. So what you're describing is a situation where people define science itself in a certain kind of narrower, you know, kind of target-oriented way, and then it becomes not their method to do otherwise and not their mindset to think otherwise.
Right, so it becomes institutionalized.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes institutionalized and becomes taken for granted as the way to do things, and it in a way becomes part of the reward structures of scientists, the structures of recognition and reward. It's easier to get published if you're looking at the effects of an individual chemical, because it's easier to set up that experiment and find results, conclusive results. And so in that sense, it's easy to get published. It's easier to get grants, to get tenure, to support students and employees. And so there is a whole academic structure in entomology that gets set up around this kind of control-oriented framework. Complex issues are hard to study. It's hard to come up with conclusive results for those kinds of interactive studies, and especially in the case of honeybees. You talk to any honeybee scientist, these are extremely laborious, labor-intensive, and complex studies to be able to look at multiple beehives in the field and look at multiple effects. To set up that experiment, to set up multiple experiments like that, it's not easy. We're not talking, simple issues here. So, resources, funding, and a different way of looking at complexity are needed.
So, what we have here is a situation where, through our advanced technological society, we have unleashed various different things that had some beneficial upside but may have some not so good downside on the world. They're all out there functioning interactively, and we haven't institutionalized a science, an infrastructure for scientific research, the funding for the same thing that will actually allow us to kind of understand the impact that we are having on the world. So we let the cat out of the multiple cats out of the bag, and then we're just looking out there for one cat, you know. They're all kind of interactive in some way, and it's like not only do we not have a structure for science that allows us to see what these effects are so that we can protect ourselves and the rest of the natural world from harmful ones like what we're talking about today, colony collapse disorder, which affects the honeybees, but, you know, we can't even it's hard then for people to even get their minds around the fact that this is happening, because, you know, we also, the science that you describe is also the science that is, and this is my field, you know, the media, it's the science, the way we talk about science, what we say science can do, what we look for in our thinking about science. We say we're pro-science. You know, a lot of people are like, well, I, you know, and I'm among them, of course, you know, I believe what the science of climate change shows. I don't believe, you know, that this is a fabrication. I'm pro-science, many people will say, and I certainly am. But which science are we pro? If we are pro a too narrow science that fails to do the complete assessment, then we also can, you know, and this goes out to the media, be manipulated easily. This is the cause, this isn't the cause, you know. No, it couldn't be that. Yes, it could be, you know. It's like there isn't a simple, quick fix on interactive problems, you know, and yet we're not permitted intellectually to know that.
Right, and part of the issue here is even how we think of science. You know, when we say biology, you know, or a biologist, or a sociologist, or sociology, the lines that we draw, the boundaries that we draw, sometimes may not be helpful in understanding interaction and complexity. Let's just go back to the case of honeybees. Now, you know, biologists study honeybees, and then the understanding is that sociologists study the people side of honeybees, which is the beekeepers and policy. But a different take of interaction can be that from the very get-go, people and bees are together, in the sense that honeybees and their biology and their physiology and their genetics, all of these are affected by beekeeping practices and by agricultural practices, by the landscapes in which they're situated. And so the very biology of bees then is already shaped by the way they're managed. And this has been the case for centuries now. And so from the very get-go, a bee that's emerging from her pupa, an adult bee, her biology, her genetics is actually already in interaction with the people who bred these bees. Okay, so in this sense of interaction, it's not there's people on one side and bees on the other side, and let's look at how they're interacting. But the people and bees are already so deeply entangled from the very get-go that we can't separate them. Okay, so when you talk about the science of honeybees, and we only say, well, the biology of bees, and then separate from the sociology of beekeeping, I feel like that's part of the issue here, is how we understand and think about this whole issue. And I believe, at least, that we need to look at them together from the very get-go, that having this division between biology and social science is not helpful here.
That's so interesting. I just want to back up for a moment and say to our listeners that I'm talking with Sainath Suryanarayanan, I hope I got that right, author with Daniel E. Kleinman of Vanishing Bees, Science, Politics, and Honeybee Health. We're talking, it's a Rutgers University Press publication, new book that's out, you know, that is our whole conversation here is about and based on. For those of you who are interested and would like to go out and purchase this book, very interesting reading. Let's kind of begin tying this, you know, a bit more together in the last 15 minutes or so of our show, which is, you know, we've talked about interactivity. You've just made an excellent point about the connection between the sociology of humans and the bees. You know, how what insights do you have from looking at these interconnections about what is going on with colony collapse disorder, the massive die-off of bees in our time? You know, what is going on? What is your understanding based on, you know, on what you've seen looking at it through this more interactive lens?
Mm-hmm. Here's what we think is going on. How we know what we know and don't know about colony collapse disorder is deeply intertwined with the politics and the history of relationships between various stakeholders, beekeepers, scientists, growers, governmental regulators. So the knowledge and ignorance about this issue are tied with the politics and history of these issues as they have developed together. Okay, these cannot be disentangled from each other. Politics and knowledge are going together. And so when we see that most of the honeybees in the United States are actually managed by beekeepers, so when we are talking colony collapse disorder or other kinds of honeybee deaths, we're also talking about the ways in which beekeepers are managing bees. And when we are talking about the ways, the practices of beekeepers, we start talking about the factors that affect beekeepers' practices. Why do beekeepers keep bees in certain ways? And in this sense, the health of bees is deeply connected to the social, historical institutions that are concerned with bees.
Could you give an example of that, for example? Like, give us some concrete examples of how those decisions and that interaction actually is affecting the bees' health.
Sure. So we earlier in the conversation, we had talked about this great interdependence between honeybees and our agricultural system. Now, this interdependence that that we see today is not something that just came about naturally, but it happened because of a certain set of historical circumstances, which were that in by the mid-20th century in the United States, farm sizes were shooting up, use of intensive chemical fertilizers and pesticides was going up, and farmers who had until then taken for granted local wild insect pollinators, wasps, all kinds of solitary bees, species, etc., they started finding that they were not getting enough pollination done. These insects were vanishing, partly due to the kinds of agricultural practices that were being administered. You know, if you want to use herbicides to remove all the weeds, well, the so-called weeds are the very places where solitary bees were nesting. They're gone for clean farming purposes, etc. So, or the pesticide practices that were getting used that hammered a lot of the beneficial insects as well. So this is the context in which farmers turn to beekeepers to rent beehives. They start depending on beekeepers for pollination. And beekeepers, who until then, around the mid-20th century, had mainly depended on producing honey for their revenue, now started seeing a niche opportunity, a niche market for pollination. Okay, and that's the particular circumstance in which the institutions of agriculture and beekeeping shape bees, because pollination and commercial pollination, as it started up, completely changed the landscape of beekeeping practices and how bees started getting treated by beekeepers. We're talking trucking across major interstate highways across the United States. These bees on their trucks, when they're on the trucks, they go through major various kinds of stresses, right? They're fed high fructose corn syrup while they're on the truck.
Oh,
they are
taking in
gasoline fumes, etc. So,
my God,
what has been derisively called as feedlot beekeeping has arisen, and feedlot beekeeping arose in this context of commercial pollination, of business of pollination, and this has probably affected honeybee health and how honeybees, what kinds of dangers honeybees are facing today. And so this is a very concrete example of the deep connections between beekeeping practices, shifts in beekeeping practices, and honeybees and their health.
I would say so. My God, they've been put on an industrial model, just like the chickens, just like, you know, I mean, they've this mass model. You know, they've been drafted into that, and they, you know, they're fragile creatures. There's a fragile dynamic here. And so we've just kind of played around with that, and we basically not only, you know, we basically, I mean, in the case of fracking or, you know, and all of that, we pollute communities, but here we just take populations of species and drag them around to fit our mass industrial supply chain lines, and, you know, it may not suit, you know, every species on Earth to be enlisted into a kind of form of slave labor, really, for our practices. That is horrific. Horrific.
Honeybees are today our pollination workhorses, migrant laborers, you know, along with the commercial beekeepers who are doing this kind of migrant pollination labor to pollinate various crops. And they have been underappreciated. And in a way, this colony collapse disorder news has a silver lining, which is that there is a greater awareness among the public of the importance of these insects, of these humble insects, but also of the beekeepers who are doing these services for the agriculture and for us.
Yeah, that's amazing. Your book, Vanishing Bees, Science, Politics, and Honeybee Health, by Sainat Suryanarayanan and Daniel Lee Kleinman. Let me just ask you, you know, the kind of core question that, you know, kind of human-centric humans always want to know. We have this quote attributed to Albert Einstein. I'm not 100% sure he actually said this. If so, it was quite prescient. You know, supposedly he said this in 1965. I'm sure you've heard it, Dr. Tsai. If the bee disappeared off the surface of the globe, then man would have only 4 years of life left. No more bees, no more pollination, no more plants, no more animals, no more man. You know, this is actually, we're obviously playing around with mankind's survival in various different ways. If one looked back, you know, took a big step back and looked at all of the things that we so cavalierly are doing on Earth, you know, many of them are heading down a kind of, unfortunately, doomed direction if we don't, you know, kind of recorrect, you know, and sort of shift course, which is obviously difficult to do with so many of these entrenched infrastructures. You know, how far off, you know, could we potentially be from the scenario that the greatest, you know, one of the greatest scientists of all time has described?
You know, I take this quote as a signaling something that could happen, but I take it as something that is metaphorical and something that is not actual in terms of the 4 years, but signaling to us that the great importance of not only bees, but also other pollinating insects, and bees being the canary in the proverbial coal mine of those insect pollinators, and honeybees being the very tip of the iceberg of this much broader decline in the abundance and diversity of pollinating insects in various parts of the world. So taken from that broad sense, we are in trouble. And in many ways, the success of our civilization is is also the bane of our civilization. The kinds of things that allow us to have the lifestyles that we do are the treadmills of consumption and production on which we are running are the very treadmills that are taking us to possible disaster. And it may not be 4 years, but you know, all the talk of climate change and the talk of the Anthropocene, that we are living in this new era of the Anthropocene, where humans as a species are affecting the planet at a geoplanetary scale. Okay, so if from that, all that, taking all of that into account, yes, this quote should be taken seriously. But not in its practical, literal sense. That's my position on it.
We have just about 5 minutes left for the show at this point. You know, so I guess it's a little bit much to go into diversity, but one of the things I just wanted to pick up this thread, because one of the things you just last said was that, you know, there's a diversity that we used to have, and in building these industrial chains of monocrops and you know, and things that harm diversity, and in fact, you know, we don't have enough respect, perhaps, for diversity. Before we end, and just very quickly, if you wouldn't mind, Dr. Tsai, you know, what is the role of diversity in biology and in life?
Well, I mean, yeah, that's a... I can't answer that question in, you know, I would need a whole hour to answer that.
Well, we may have to bring you back then.
Yeah. Diversity at multiple different levels and scales of organization allows for a certain level of flexibility to respond to various kinds of environments. And when those, when that diversity is reduced or taken away, then the extent of possible responses, the capacity of organisms to respond to shifts in the environments is also taken away. And that spells extinction.
All right. Thank you. That is very, very clear. So this whole sense, even on a political day, because this show happens to be recorded on the day of the inauguration, we're not going to get into that level of politics for the moment, except to say that the whole sense that, you know, we need all different kinds of beings, people, plants, pollinators, that actually diversity is a key to life and survival and multiple options and resilience in our world, I think is very apropos, even though this show will be broadcast about 2 weeks or so from now, for our time to really understand and honor that. I come from a very multi-ethnic city of New York City, and so it's something that I feel very blessed personally to, you know, have just imbibed from my environment. Not everybody has that blessing, but, you know, it's worth a try, you know, to appreciate that on all of its multiple levels. Sure.
If I can just make one last point, which is concerning the book and diversity, is that an important point of the book is that in terms of understanding what's happening to honeybees, we need to have a more diverse set of approaches and methods and understandings toward grappling with the complexity. And part of this diversity should include, we believe, this is a normative position you're taking, should include various beekeepers' ways of understanding honeybee health. So the diversity of health of honeybees, diversity in health of honeybees, we are saying needs to be connected to the diversity of approaches that people are taking to understand those issues.
Mm. Beautiful, beautiful. So it's like diversity in biology, diversity in sociology, diversity in science. thank you so much for talking with me today. Sainath Suryanarayanan, Vanishing Bees, is his book, Science, Politics, and Honeybee Health. Definitely a worthy read and a very important topic. And I thank you for, you know, the diversity of the different facets of this that you encompass and hold, and the model of understanding and of true living science that you are sharing and embodying and pursuing. Just a really great honor to have you on Connect the Dots today. Thank you so much. Thank you, listeners, too, for being with us this and every week on Connect the Dots, for conversation about all of the different things that affect our world. I kind of regard this, Dr. Tsai, as a quintessential Connect the Dots program. We'll have to have you back.
Wonderful.
It's been a pleasure. Yeah, thank you so much for the work
you
do.
Thank you. Thank you.
And thank you, listeners, for being with us on Connect the Dots. We'll be with you again next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Be well and chin up.